Welcome, everybody. It's time once again for the next chapter with Charlie Hedges. As he explores turning the page on his life and yours. Hey, Charlie.
Hey, Paul. You know, sometimes the next chapter involves a radical move. Our guest today is a perfect example. Donna Frankhart transitioned from an executive travel agent to becoming a deputy coroner. Today, we talk about Donna's new book, I've Seen Dead People, Diary of a Deputy Coroner. In our lively conversation, Donna tells us about the life of a deputy coroner, visions of death, and poignant insights into the meaning of life and death. In what may seem like a darker subject, I think you will be surprised how engaging and meaningful our conversation is. Let's welcome former deputy coroner, Donna Frankhart. Donna Frankhart, welcome to the next chapter with Charlie.
Thank you so much for having me, Charlie. It's a pleasure to be with you tonight.
You know, I've read your book. I've Seen Dead People, Diary of a Deputy Coroner. You know, I really feel like I learned so much, Donna, and I'm very much looking forward to our chat today because you covered so much territory in your book.
Thank you. Yes, I had a lot to say. I had a lot in my head that I needed to pour onto paper.
Oh, so many cases. You know what I'd like to do is I would like to start this show at the most obvious place, which is the beginning. Now, both of us know that when you ask kids, what do they want to be when they grow up? You're not going to find a lot of those kids saying, I want to be a coroner.
No, that's not one that would be at the top of the list, and it's certainly wasn't for me. As a matter of fact, when I was younger, death frightened me, and I was not one to find all the horror movies on TV either, and I didn't like the dark. So, you know, really, in looking back, you think, wow, it's amazing how your life takes turns, how it changes. And I think it was just that was my mission in life. It was what I was meant to do.
So if you're meant to do, how did that happen? How did you become a coroner? Without that being your set goal and set direction, you discovered that in process, did you not?
I did. What had happened was, well, first I should preface in saying that my career was always in the travel industry, government travel, corporate travel. And back in about 2006,
I have to say, you've kind of stayed in travel. It's the psychic travel business.
Yes. And this is kind of a warped sense of humor, but I used to say years ago, because I continued working in the travel business during the week, but then I was a deputy coroner on the weekends. And how I did get into that was because I was going through a divorce and had two sons that were young in grade school. And so I wanted to do something constructive, something to help the community on the weekends that that my sons would be with their dad. And so I had heard of this program or this team that was called it was a crisis response team. And it was all volunteers, and you would have a pager, and any time that you were available, you would help in any calls such as death, disturbances, but you were more of the emotional support for the families or the loved ones of whatever the call was for.
Now, you received training for that, right? I mean, they didn't just throw you out in the field and say, be a...
Oh, right, absolutely. I did have some medical background. It was very minimal. It was like I had the certified nursing assistant certification. I'd worked as a medical assistant for a couple of nephrologists, now nephrologists. They specialize in kidney, diabetes. So I'd had that, and I'd also worked at a hospital on a neurosurgical floor. So I had some past medical experience. However, I did have to interview in front of a panel of police officers, and it was four or five police departments in the area, this crisis response team. And so I interviewed, I was accepted, and then I did go through training for about 8-9 months.
Oh, really? Really? What did that include?
Yes. Well, it was mainly more on the how to handle the actual scenes, as far as obviously you weren't going to be doing the hands-on with the body because we didn't have that qualification. It would be helping families, the process, how to deal with the many emotions of the families, because, you know, it can range anywhere from fear to anger to, you know, people, you just never know how they're going to react when there's any type of tragedy or violence. Or so it was more of psychological.
Yeah, sort of a primer to a psychology course.
Almost, yes, yes. You weren't that involved, but it was just, you know, if you're going to be dealing with the families, you needed to know how to handle the situation, try to keep things at an even keel while the case was being worked. And so in the process of being a crisis responder, it seemed like every time I would answer a page, there was always someone asking me to help remove the body. I'm referring to the decedent, physically, to help carry the body out. And so in watching the investigations going on, I was very intrigued, because forensics was also very interesting. It was always interesting to me. And so the coroner had seen, one of the coroners in one of the counties had seen how I dealt with the families and how I handled situations, and had complimented me on it. And I'd asked him if he was looking for a deputy. And he wasn't at the time, but I you know, said to him, please, if you're ever considering hiring on another, I would be very interested. And so about a year later, then I got a call from that particular coroner. He was considering hiring on another deputy, but he wanted me to test the waters first. So what I did was I followed him on all of his cases for about another 9 or 10 months. And it's in the book that I wrote. It's like some of these cases that I put in there, I, of course, changed things a little bit just for the privacy and the confidentiality of the families, the protection of the families. But my very first call with him was a suicide. Coroners or deputy coroners, we go out on all of the suspicious or unexpected deaths. So you get, you know, tragedies. You've got homicides, suicides, fatalities, drownings, overdoses. It's all unexpected deaths. And so,
unexpected deaths. Like, so what is an expected death? Is that elderly? Is that what that?
An expected. Well, even the elderly can be unexpected. Expected would be someone who has a very the medical history, there's a lot of medical issues.
Right.
They might be on hospice.
Right.
So it's expected that their health is deteriorating, and it's inevitable that it's, you know, whether it's a terminal illness. Unexpected would be someone that seemed to be fine, and next thing you know, you find them dead. Or they drop, or even unexpected would be a car fatality.
Sure,
right?
Of course. So I imagine, you know, the majority of deaths are unexpected, are they not?
The majority of them are, yes.
Yes.
And
so you're quite busy.
Actually, yes. So I was doing that, the deputy coroner position, on a part-time basis. I was working travel during the week. I'd work till like 6 o'clock on a Friday night, and then by 7 o'clock I was ready and had my pager on, and then I'd be on call. Some weekends it was until Sunday. Many times I'd just do 12-hour shifts. But there were times when I would start my travel job on a Friday morning at 8 o'clock in the morning, and by the time I might have to work a little over at travel, then I'm rushing to get ready for my, to be, because I'm on call, and I'm going until like 3 o'clock the next day. Nonstop. I mean, there's a lot of people dying out there.
Donna, what
I mean,
is
that respectfully,
what,
but
what is the time that it takes by the time, you know, a deputy coroner arrives on the scene to the time you have completed mm-hmm. your duties at that scene? Is that a 2-hour time period, a 4-hour time period?
What? It varies. It depends on the type of death. So let's mm-hmm. say, for example, there were some cases that I was paged out on that might have been a car fatality. It could take up to 6 hours, because
sure.
depending on where the fatality is, how much you have the pieces, you know, because you go through your duties are that the coroner, I'm going to refer to just myself, right, or the deputy coroner.
Sure.
Deputy coroners are hired and sworn in. Coroners are elected officials. So the deputy coroner.
The coroner is elected? You mean I'm electing my coroners?
Yes.
I don't even recall voting for a coroner. No kidding. I did not know that.
Yes.
That shows how much attention I pay to my voting.
or coroners, thankfully. So a case could take up to 6 hours.
Yes.
And a lot of it could possibly be, well, again, depending on the case, it could be you're picking up the pieces, so to speak, literally and figuratively. Then you're waiting for the funeral. You've got photos to take. You're drawing fluids for toxicology. You're deciding whether there's going to be an autopsy. Then you're waiting for either the transport to come, and if you order an autopsy, to take the body down to the morgue for the autopsy, or to whatever funeral home if there's not going to be an autopsy. So it takes time. It could be anywhere from an hour to 6-7 hours. It just depends on the case.
And you're dealing with, you know, from unexpected, from just, it could be a heart attack for a young person, and it could be family abuse, it could be a car accident, right. It could be a homicide. You know, you're dealing with some pretty difficult situations.
Very difficult. And the thing is, when you see a body, you're looking at it and you're thinking, okay, so, you know, maybe they had a heart attack, but now, well, wait a minute, wait, we've got to check that body, because there's things you're going to look for. If that body's laying on its back, but you see pooling of the blood on the stomach, that means they might have been moved. Okay, if they've moved, they're dead. Somebody's moved them. Now, is that something suspicious? Has somebody killed them and moved them to the location that you found them? You also want to go over the body and look for any kind of stab wound, anything. And you're looking in the eyes for, it's called petechia. It's where there's like little red dots from like trauma. It shows up almost like little, not black and blue marks, but injury to the eye. So like if somebody's been choked, or there's a hanging, you can see that in the eye. There's just so many pieces to put together. And the coroner has possession of the body, and then the crime scene is in possession of the police or the detective. So in unison, you all work together. But the coroner is the one, like when the coroner shows up, the body is not touched or moved until the coroner gets there. The coroner has to pronounce the time of death. So let's say the body wasn't discovered for a week or two, hypothetically. The time of death is going to be the time that the coroner got there and pronounced it.
Oh, so it's not when the person died, it's when the coroner pronounced the death.
When the coroner, yes, and I'm going to, and I'm sure it's universal, but I mean, I'm speaking for what I was trained and what we did in my county. But
now
the coroner shows up.
Something that, you know, I think perhaps I've watched too much TV, but I have always been under the impression that a coroner is a physician. But that's not, is that true or is that not true?
Well, now, forensic pathologists will do autopsies. So first off, coroners, unless their pathologists or their doctors, will not do the autopsies. In the county that I worked in, you did not have to have a medical background. The other deputies that I worked with, one was also, everybody, all of my associates, they all had at least another job or a couple of jobs. So one was a paramedic and then a deputy coroner. The other one was a fire battalion chief with the fire department and a deputy coroner. There was a nurse, there was a chaplain, there was myself, as I'd mentioned, the little bit of background that I had in the medical field. There was also a deputy, actually ended up being a chief deputy, and he had no medical background. He worked at a particular soda company. I'm not sure what his position was, but he didn't have any medical background. And people would ask me all of the time, well, are you a doctor? No, I'm not a doctor. But the thing is, we're there, it's called medical legal death investigation. So we are there to rule out anything suspicious. If we don't find that there's anything suspicious, and of course, we're putting all the pieces together, we're questioning if there's any witnesses, we're getting medical records to see if there were any issues medically, or when was the last time people saw this person, check the mail, you know, was there a lot of mail stacking up? If it's just strictly medical and it's an elder, let's say an elderly person, we're not going to order an autopsy for being suspicious, but the family does have the right to request an autopsy. However, it would be out of pocket for them. And at the time, now I haven't been a deputy since 2015, but at that time it was around $3,000 or $4,000 an autopsy.
Is it a mental, or is there an actual checklist that you go through and you check that you can report to, that you check certain criteria for? Is this is this suspicious or is this not suspicious?
Well, we would have reports we'd have to fill out, which would have everything from, you know, the obvious, the name, date of birth, all the personal information. And then we'd have the body cut out on there so you could write down where you might see markings. And it's like a lot of spots to fill in the blanks. So, yes, it's like a list that you go down.
I imagine a lot of photographs as well.
Yes, would also take photos of the decedent. And as I'd mentioned, we'd draw fluids, which would be either blood, urine, or vitreous. Vitreous is out of the eye, and I usually preferred the vitreous, taking out of the eye, and then that would be sent for toxicology. We would go over the body, as I'd mentioned before, to see if there were any markings. Of course, the position of the body, the condition of the body. There's just so many aspects of an investigation, things that you have to, the protocol.
I have one more high-level question before we get down and dirty and we start talking about some of the experiences. But I do have this question. You mentioned coroners, deputy coroners, and it appeared from your description that there is no similarity in job background or industry. What would you say, in your opinion, after seeing this, what is a common denominator? What sort of drives people or encourages people to become a deputy coroner?
Mm-hmm. You know, that's a good question, and I had heard several years ago that supposedly many people that get into the public servant positions that at some point in time in their lives they had some type of tragedy. So they're caregivers, they're empathetic. Mm-hmm. Now for me, in my background, I had an uncle that was murdered when I must have been in my late teens, early 20s. And then I had another uncle that was mugged, and so he was stabbed and slashed. So, and other, through the years, other tragedies of friends and fatalities. So I think...
Your heart, to who you are, and rouse curiosity, may I say, or interest in how do you resolve some of this? Do you think that's common among the people that are doing these duties?
I honestly do. You have to be very empathetic and compassionate. And I'm also wondering, because I've, of course, thought about the years and how, you know, and looking back now, it's like, oh my God, to think I actually did so many years of that. But I think to myself, at the time when I did go in the direction that I did, was I thinking, okay, so my marriage was failed. I was, you know, it was a failing marriage. I wanted to do something that I felt like I could help others, because I wanted to do something good. I wanted to do good things and to feel good about myself, because I kind of felt a little bit like a failure in my marriage. I mean, you know, without getting into all of that,
of course.
you know, it takes two, and it just didn't work.
Yeah,
but
so you felt the need to contribute.
I wanted to contribute, and I wanted to help others, and I wanted to be able to be with families in their darkest hour, and even if they didn't remember my name or my face, at least be able to think on that terrible day of the tragedy that there was someone there that actually cared about their loved one. And that's the way I treated everyone, almost like family. I mean, obviously, I was very professional in doing the investigation. But then when the investigation was over, I would sit with the families and I would talk to them about sure. their loved one, because it was their mother, father, sister, brother.
Right.
It wasn't just a body laying on the side of the road or, you know, whatever the circumstances were.
We've sort of covered sort of the idea of what a coroner is, what a deputy coroner is, what some of your duties. You know, what I want to do right now is I'd like to run through a scenario. And here's my scenario. You're at home doing whatever normal life does, and you get your coroner pager ringing on your phone, and you discover it's a very tragic death. It's a suicide, or it's a homicide, or if it's you know, perhaps a driving accident, a drunk driving accident. Tell me what happens after that. But what goes on immediately? You know, just kind of walk me through that process.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's say it's a fatality.
Okay.
And the pager goes off, right? And then I answer the page, and it was usually a sergeant or a lieutenant of whichever department is on scene at the accident.
Okay, so it's
I'm
police
grabbing
force.
The police, yes.
Yes, okay.
They're kind of briefing me on what I'm going to be, you know, going to as I'm grabbing a body bag and all of my supplies, and I'm flying out the door. Because when I would be on call, I would always be dressed in the uniform and be ready to go, because you want to be there as quickly as you can.
Oh, really?
As soon as I'd get, yes. Because, well, first off, depending on where the scene is, if it's where there's a lot of traffic, you want to be able to get that taken care of so that these poor passers-by aren't seeing these horrific things, right?
Right.
So,
and the police can't do anything until the coroner arrives.
Right.
Okay.
Right. So we get there, or I get there, and they'll brief you. You sign in, right? And then let's say there's a car off on the side. It hit a tree. I go over to the vehicle, and, you know, if it's obvious that the person has expired, the paramedics, there was nothing that they could do, then I'm going over to the vehicle. Actually, I would get help in moving the body. Well, the police would be with me, and then I would pronounce the time. When everybody's documenting the time of death, then...
And that's the time you're calling the death. That's not the time that the person died.
That's the time that the coroner arrives.
Okay, got it. Got it. Just clear.
Yep.
Just wanted to be clear on that. Okay.
Yep. So then... we remove, of course, I couldn't do it by myself. I would have help. And then we would have let me back up. I'm sorry. A funeral home would be called. And when the funeral home would get to the scene, they would bring their cot.
Okay.
Or gurney.
Sure.
And then they would help to pull the body out.
But the body's already been bagged?
See, it all depends on the case.
Okay,
someone
would
help me pull the body out, depending on the condition, or
sure.
if there's going to be an autopsy, what the circumstance, there's just so many, you know, different...
If there's an autopsy, does it go through the funeral home, or does it go through the police?
Again, the coroner has possession of the body. So if it's
okay.
going to be an autopsy, the coroner would then, they're in this area... The county that I worked in, there was a transport service. Now, this transport service were actually also, they were funeral directors. They had to be funeral directors. But the transport service would come they would remove the body, put the body, depending again on the condition of the body, whether it was going to be in a body bag, and then on top of the gurney, or just the body on top of the gurney, and then the funeral directors would transport the body to the morgue for the autopsy, not to their funeral home, to the morgue. Again, and depending on if it's high profile, what the circumstances are, it might be a case where the coroner has to follow the transport to the morgue, and that's once the body bag has been zipped up, the coroner bags and tags, because these tags have identification numbers on them. So it seals the bag with the body inside so that nothing can be tampered. And then when it's taken down for autopsy, then the pathologist or the forensic technicians will cut off the tag, because they'll have that ID number and they'll know that that body has not been tampered with.
So you, with your team, with the team of police, your team of other coroners, mm-hmm. there's a lot of responsibility and discretion about how that body is processed afterward that really could have repercussions. I mean, it's a very serious position that you have in making those decisions, is it not?
It's very serious.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Are you aware of that all the time? Is that taxing for you to say, gee, what's my decision? Do you err on the safe side, or, you know, what?
Extremely stressful, because, yes, I mean, if you miss something, first, you know, you think of all of the, if there was something suspicious that caused that person's death and you didn't catch that, that means someone got away with killing someone. That means the decedent lost their life by the hands of another. And I mean, like you said, there's a lot of responsibility. So yes, absolutely. I was extremely focused. And when there were times when there were actually some cases where there was one in particular I'm thinking of where there was
Tell me about it.
Where the sheriff felt that, one of the sheriffs felt that there should be an autopsy. I wasn't so sure about it, and forgive me, I don't remember all of the circumstances. I've done over a couple thousand cases. So I then call my boss, who is the coroner, the elected official. And then it's like it goes between the sheriff and the coroner, and I thought, I'll let my boss decide on
good,
that one.
Sure, that's wise. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I want to do now, Donna, is I want to talk about, we've given an overview here. I want to talk about how this has impacted you, how you manage the situation, and what conclusions you've had about life, because you have had tons of conclusions mm-hmm. about life lessons in life lessons and death lessons. And we're going to take a brief break, and we are going to come right back and do those questions. Hi there, you're listening to The Next Chapter with Charlie, and this is Charlie Hedges, and my esteemed guest today is Donna Frankhart, Deputy Coroner in Wisconsin, and she has, did you say thousands of cases, Donna?
It was a couple thousand, yes.
Couple thousand cases of people who have, you know, I personally do not, personally, this is my personal issue, so I might as well just say it, that listeners know. Mm-hmm. I have a disdain for the word passing away. People don't pass away, they die. So I'm not afraid to use the word die. We used it all mm-hmm. until the last 20 years, and it's become a euphemism for it. But Don, have mm-hmm. you seen a lot of dead people? Now,
yes.
Does someone in your position ever get accustomed or numbed by seeing a dead person?
Never. I never did. No, I mean, everyone was. Do you remember years ago? I don't know if it was a movie, if it was a series, what it was. It was called something like A Thousand Ways to Die. Do you remember that?
I do not.
Okay, well, it was whatever this was, a program, it would talk about all the different ways to die. And there are so many different ways to die. It's just every one was so unique and different. And every time I'd see a dead person, it just chiseled away at my heart and my, you know, my brain, my thoughts, my whole being. And the thing is with, and I'll say dead people, and I'm sorry, the reason I was always saying the person had passed away was because families, it seemed to bother them more.
I agree. You know, you're in that position where you must do that. Yeah, I get that completely.
Yeah, or the decedent instead of the dead body.
Yeah, decedent sounds like L.A. law. You know, so I said the decedent sounds like L.A. law. You know, the TV series.
Right. Yeah, CSI, right? And dying. You leave your body. Now, I should back up here. With all of the deaths, there were many souls and spirits that attached to me. Most would follow me home and would not go over my threshold, but some of them did attach to me. So I cannot deny my own personal experiences with death. That when you leave your body, there is so much more. Because I've seen it, I've heard it, I've felt it, my sons have experienced it, and I cannot deny it.
How does that impact you, Donna? How does that impact your understanding and your knowledge of death?
Do you know that in having spirits that have done and said things to me and that I've witnessed, that I don't fear death. I used to fear death. I don't fear death anymore because I know that there's so much more. And as a matter of fact, I took care of my mom for her last 5 months of her life. She was put on hospice and she moved in with me. And so it was the only time in my life that I actually witnessed active dying. I mean, I'd been around a lot of dead people, but to actually witness someone dying, and it's going to sound strange, but it was a very beautiful thing. And when she took her last breath and just being there, witnessing, holding her hand, it was beautiful. I could feel my ancestors waiting, my dad and everybody waiting for her. And that's a whole another topic we could talk about.
Yeah, that is a whole podcast. But that's do you think it's because you had so many interactions with the dead that occurred to you, or is that, do you find that to be more common with just individual families as well? Do you find it to be more common with you because you've had so many occurrences with death?
Mm-hmm. Well, I was raised Catholic, and without getting into too much with religion, but
we can, that's okay.
Okay, and I pray every day, and in death I am always looking for the beauty. Like in my book, I have takeaways. So with every case and every horrific thing that I experienced and I witnessed, I wanted to process and compartmentalize in my brain the positives of death. And I'm sorry you asked me the question about was it me personally as far as fearing death or?
Oh no, I was asking, do you think you have encounters with the spirit world because you've had so many encounters with dead than you know, the average person is going to have. Do you think that had something to do with you having more encounters with spirit world?
Yes, I absolutely do. It was a constant thing for many years. And I have not been in that position since 2015, but I can tell you that things are still happening. As a matter of fact, a few weeks ago, I was in my car. I had just started my car, and I was going to back up, put it in reverse, and all of a sudden, a rotary phone started ringing, and I looked around that back seat. I put it in park, and I'm looking around thinking, well, that's the strangest thing. Remember the sound of the old rotary phones ringing, right?
Right.
Okay, so I thought, oh, I must be hearing things, So then I put it back in reverse. I backed out. I started to go forward, and the phone started ringing again. I thought, all right. I put it in park because I was still in a parking lot. Turned back, looked in my car in the back seat, and I knew I didn't have a phone back there, but it was just the weirdest thing. And I know that it was someone from beyond that was trying to connect with me. I think that with it happening so often through the years and being around death, I was more aware of the spiritual world. And I have had mediums tell me that I'm like a lighthouse for the spirits, because I was actually doing the work of, this is what she told, one of them told me, I was doing the work of God because I was with my compassion, being empathetic and helping the families and the decedent, and always treating every decedent with dignity at the crime scene. There would be times the family just had to see their loved one last time, and if there wasn't going to be an autopsy, I would clean their faces up, and I'd put a pillow under their head, and I'd put, this is obviously, you know, if it's in a home death or where I'd have access to a pillow or a blanket, and I'd make them look like they were sleeping so that it was, you know, a little bit easier on the family. And so I think that I became a beacon for the spirits. They were like attracted to me.
Is that common for deputy coroners, or do you think that was a unique experience for you?
I tell you what, Charlie, I don't know how many people in the death industry will admit this to the public. I would guarantee you there are many of them that are experiencing the spirit world. I have a friend who's a chief coroner. Actually, I met her through this book being written, and because she is a woman in this, there's a, you know, well, men and women in this career, but she was so thankful that she had another female deputy coroner, or that I used to be, that would understand what she'd go through. And her husband is a police officer. She's in a southern state, and she was just telling me last month, and she said, oh, my God. She said, we have so much activity. She said it's so bad that every night her husband turns the fan on in the bedroom, because every night at like around 1 o'clock in the morning, they hear the footsteps going down the hallway, and then they feel the bed as this spirit sits down on the bed, and her husband can't stand the sound of the footsteps, and they can't stop the spirit. It's a home that it was generations of, like, his grandparents owned and then his parents owned, so they won't sell the house because, you know, it's been in the family for so long. But they're dealing with that on a constant basis. Then I had a forensic technician who's out of Great Britain tell me, again, I met him through my book, and he was telling me, oh, yeah, we have things flying off the shelves in the morgue. And funeral directors that I've worked with, they put lavender around in the rooms because that's supposed to, like, keep the spirits at bay.
Oh, so it's not garlic around the front door? We're not trying to keep vampires out?
Well, maybe some of them. And, you know, I'm very thankful that I have only always attracted goodness, good spirits. I didn't have any of that bad stuff, and I don't ever hopefully plan to ever witness that. So.
Well, like you said, we could do a whole show on that, and that is fascinating.
Yeah.
And I think it's something that is neither provable nor disprovable. It is each individual family and each individual person, their experience, mm-hmm. and there's tons of evidence, you know, as you say. What I'd like to do is I'd like to wrap up our show, and I would like to, every chapter, as you said earlier, every chapter of your book concludes mm-hmm. with what you call a takeaway. It's sort of a lessons learned, and
yes.
As I read through those lessons learned, through those takeaways, you make it obvious that you learned as much about life as you did about death as a deputy coroner, that you made excellent observations. So let's just go through in our next 5 or so minutes, let's just go through just death. And I'm not talking about life after death, but I'm talking about the death experience itself. What did you learn about death and dying?
I learned that death should not be feared, and death is part of life. I also learned that life is precious, and we should never take for granted anything in life, anyone. Tell your loved ones often how much you love them, hug them, appreciate the vibrant colors of flowers when you're out on a walk or feeling the breeze on your face. I mean, I sometimes go overboard because I am so thankful and appreciative for every breath that I take, because at any moment it can be taken away from you. And don't ever leave this life with regrets that you didn't tell someone, your mother, whatever, family, loved one, that you love them, that you didn't spend enough time with them. Be in the present, and like I say, fill in the blanks between the date of birth and the date of death. Leave your footprints in life.
And perhaps it's like the common thing today is begin the day as if it's the first day of your life. Perhaps if we began the day as if it's the last day of our life, we would live it very differently.
I love that. That's beautiful.
Yeah, it just occurred to me, and that is, and your appreciation, you know, I think we chatted about this on the phone. You know, the ancient philosophers in the Middle Ages, the famous philosophers, all had it was very common that they would have a human skull on their desk, because they felt they could not do adequate philosophy without having a firm grasp on the reality of death. That death was the driver to the philosophy of life. And if we didn't get that, we missed the point of it, because we are treating life as an immortal, eternal state, and it is not. It is finite. It is temporary. And we do not know how finite or how temporary. And so that, for that reason, every day is essential. Every day what we do is essential.
It is. Absolutely.
So maybe that translates into my next question, you know, so that was death. But you learned there were several things you talked about life. What sorts of things did you learn about life and how you live life that is essential for people to know? I have a couple in mind that I recall from your writings.
That's essential in life. Well, your body is your temple. So what you put in it today could determine how many tomorrows you have, for one thing.
Oh, don't tell me that, because I plan on eating ice cream tonight.
Well, I love ice cream too.
No, I'm teasing. I'm teasing. Please. Yes, you're right. How you treat your body.
Yes, and your mind, and things that you take for granted. For example, you're out to have a good time. I'm talking about all ages. You don't think of the consequences, you know, like car fatalities from drinking too much.
You wrote about that a lot, about drinking. You came in your book. There were so many cases, and especially of youth that died because of alcohol and you know, totally preventable and off the wall cases, you know, not somebody who just flagrantly said, I'm going to drink and drive, but just said, oh, I'm only going a couple miles and I need to go get pizzas for the rest of my party, so I'm going to get it. And they never made it back. And you have, you know, you face that and you see that, and how we take care of ourselves and to regard and to, and you sort of give the impression that what you do now really does impact who you are today and who you will be tomorrow. If you are today and if you will be tomorrow.
if you will have a tomorrow.
Yeah. Correct. Yeah.
And I don't want to sound like I'm, you know, I don't be afraid to live. Don't live in fear, but don't, and don't, but don't take for granted your life.
Yeah. Don't live in fear, but don't be stupid.
But
there's always a line there, and someone can always draw a line, but there is a definite line between wisdom and stupidity. And,
absolutely.
We have to be careful. And unfortunately, in American life, and especially American life with the youth, we have a tendency to explore and to move into areas that are dangerous for our life. You know, I certainly did. You know, I'm alive by luck and by the grace of God, you know, because of the dumb things that I did. And, you know, I'm not alone, and it just, we have to be so careful. But those are wonderful, wonderful thoughts about life. Donna, you have been so insightful, and I think we just have such a different understanding of a coroner and what's going on in the life of a coroner, what you have to face on a regular basis. What is the average career span of a deputy coroner? Do people last more than a decade at it?
I'm trying to think if I know of. Well, my former boss was, I think he was in that position for like 20 years, and he was retired law enforcement. So, you know, that's a good question. One of the deputies that I worked with, who's also a paramedic, he must be going on over 20 years.
Oh, so there are people that do it.
I'm going to look into that.
Yeah. Well, Donna Frankhart, you have been an extraordinarily fascinating guest.
Thank you so much.
And I want to thank you for spending time with me today. It's very, very kind of you, very gracious.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. I've really enjoyed our chat, and I start talking about it, and I just want to keep going. And do you mind if I mention also, and this is exciting, with my book, which has now been, there's been a screenplay adaption.
Oh, really?
Of the book, and yes, and there's going to be a feature film. So one of the director is Jeff Ulm, and he worked on some films like Titanic, The Revenant, Fifth Element.
Oh, man, huge films. That's tremendous, Donna. Congratulations. I will make sure
I
have a link to Amazon to purchase your book on the show notes. That's, again, thank you for being on. Congratulations on the book. Congratulations on the possible film. One never knows where one is going in life, does one?
One never knows. And just be thankful of every breath you take.
Okay, I'd like to thank
you so much.
Thank you. You're very, very, very welcome. I want to take this time to thank our listeners for tuning in to The Next Chapter with Charlie. And please be sure to check us out at our website, thenextchapter.life, L-I-F-E. And until next, this is Charlie Hedges signing off. Bye for now.